Hello, everybody. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Isaiah chapter 22, which I will call an oracle concerning Jerusalem. Now, we are in the middle of a series of oracles against a bunch of bad guys that surround Jerusalem. In the previous chapters, Moab, Damascus, Cush, Ethiopia, Egypt, Babylon, and now Isaiah is going to pick on his own country, Jerusalem, Judah. In the next chapter, he's going after Tyre and Sidon. So we start now in Isaiah 22, verse 1. An oracle concerning the Valley of Vision. What troubles you now that you have all gone up on the roofs? Well, this oracle concerns Sennacherib's invasion in the 14th year of Hezekiah, as the pulpit commentator says. Now, there are some people say that it refers to two invasions of Judah, the Assyrian invasion in 701 under Sennacherib and the Babylonian invasion in 586, but I don't go for that. Let me read you from the pulpit commentary. It is almost impossible to imagine any other army than the Assyrian besieging Jerusalem in Isaiah's time. Moreover, the particulars concerning the preparations made against the enemy in verses 9 through 11 agree with those mentioned in 2 Chronicles 32, 3 through 5. I'm going to show you those parallels in just a minute. As made by Hezekiah against Sennacherib in 2 Chronicles 32, it's clear, it states that it's the invasion of Sennacherib that's being talked about. Isaiah doesn't mention in chapter 22 exactly who he's talking about, but it has to be Assyria. Pulpit commentator goes on and says the second section of the chapter has certainly reference to this period of Assyria, although some people say that the second period might refer to Babylon. Cambridge commentary says it may be regarded as certain that the prophecy belongs to the period of Sennacherib's invasion, which is 701 B.C. Now, I'll mention those who think that the invasion is from Babylon as well as from Sennacherib of Assyria. Adam Clark is one who thinks so. He says that Isaiah 22, the first five verses, refers to judgment on Babylon. But Jameson Foster Brown says, no, it's Isaiah 22, 12 through 14, that refers to the judgment on Babylon, a different section of the chapter, which shows how weak the argument is for Babylon. Jameson Foster Brown says the language of Isaiah 22, verses 12 through 14, as to the infidelity and consequent utter ruin of the Jews, seems rather to foreshadow the destruction by Nebuchadnezzar in Zedekiah's reign and cannot be restricted to Hezekiah's time. Why not? Sennacherib caused a bunch of doom and gloom inside the city, a bunch of famine. So we're not going to go with these off-the-wall comments. We're going to go with the majority and say that this chapter concerns the invasion of Judah by Sennacherib of Assyria in 701 B.C., which is real nice. We don't have to get into a lot of debate about that anymore. Now, this oracle concerned the Valley of Vision. The Valley of Vision is Isaiah's poetic way of referring to Jerusalem. As the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia says, the Valley of Vision is a, quote, symbolic name generally understood to signify Jerusalem as being the home of prophetic vision. The reason it's called the Valley of Vision because it's a valley of prophets, a place where prophets are, the habitation of the prophets or seers and the seat of vision and prophecy. But now another part of that phrase, the valley, why is Jerusalem called a valley? As Jameson Fawcett Brown says, Jerusalem lay in a valley surrounded by hills higher than Mount Zion and Mount Moriah, which are two hills in Jerusalem. We see that in Psalms 125, verse 2, which says, Jerusalem, the mountains surround her. There's another option why it's called a valley of vision. Barnes says it's because there were several valleys within and adjacent to the city, but he says that's less probable than our other option, which is that Jerusalem was surrounded by mountains all around it that were higher than Jerusalem. And besides, valleys is plural, valley of vision, but valleys inside the city, why would you call valleys plural, valley singular? So, valley of vision is Jerusalem. And in verse 1, Isaiah says, what troubles you now, meaning the inhabitants of Jerusalem, that you have all gone up on the roofs? They went up on their flat-top roofs to watch the movements of the enemy. All houses back then had their outside windows obstructed with latticework. They didn't have glass. So when any commotion at all happened, everybody in the house would rush up to the rooftops to see what was going on. We move now to Isaiah 22, verses 2 through 4. Isaiah continues, O town full of commotion, O city of tumult and revelry! Your slain were not killed by the sword, nor did they die in battle. All your leaders have fled together. They have been captured without using the bow. All you who were caught were taken prisoner together, having fled while the enemy was still far away. Therefore I said, turn away from me. Let me weep bitterly. Do not try to console me over the destruction of my people. Now Isaiah refers to Jerusalem as full of revelry, commotion, tumult, and revelry. Why the revelry? Well, I'm going to give you five options. These are all from the commentator Gary Smith as to why the city of Jerusalem is having a good old time. Option number one, Judah had successfully finished all its war preparations, and so they were partying. That doesn't make sense to me. You don't party just because you finished all your war preparations. Let's look at option number two. Assyria had left Jerusalem alone so they could address the threat from Egypt, from Tarhakah, the Pharaoh of Egypt. We read that in Isaiah 37:9-10. The king, referring to Sennacherib of Assyria, had heard this about Tarhakah, king of Cush, king of Ethiopia. He has set out to fight against you. So when Sennacherib heard this, he sent messengers to Hezekiah saying, say this to Hezekiah, king of Judah, don't let your God whom you trust deceive you by promising that Jerusalem won't be handed over to the king of Assyria. But then eventually Sennacherib had to leave Jerusalem, or he was put in a position where he might have to leave Jerusalem, and the people, according to option number two, are rejoicing over this. Well, I don't think that's it either. How do the people of Jerusalem even know about Tarhakah coming up against Sennacherib? And how do they know that Sennacherib knew that Tarhakah had come up against him? I don't think that's it. Option number three, the people are partying because Hezekiah had promised to pay a lot of gold to appease Sennacherib. We read that in 2 Kings 18, verses 14 through 16. So Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent word to the king of Assyria at Lachish, saying, I have done wrong. Withdraw from me. Whatever you demand from me, I will pay. The king of Assyria demanded 11 tons of silver and 1 ton of gold from King Hezekiah of Judah. So Hezekiah gave him all the silver found in the Lord's temple and in the treasuries of the king's palace. At that time, Hezekiah stripped the gold from the doors of the Lord's sanctuary and from the doorpost he had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. So this option says that Hezekiah bought some temporary peace with Sennacherib, and the people, having realized that, started partying. Well, that's possible, I guess. Here's option number four as to why the people were partying. When Sennacherib withdrew his army, he wasn't there personally, but his army officers did. They were surrounding Jerusalem, and the plague killed 185,000 of his soldiers in one night, as is recorded in Isaiah 37, verses 36 through 37. And so this option says, the people of Jerusalem are partying because Sennacherib's army had left them alone. But there's a problem with that. We drop down to verse 7 in Isaiah 22, and we see that Sennacherib's horsemen are still at the gates. His chariots still fill Israel's valleys. Isaiah 22:7, your best valleys were full of chariots, and horsemen were positioned at the gates. And besides, this feasting, this revelry that we're talking about here, was said to be because tomorrow they might die. Isaiah 22:13, but look, joy and gladness, butchering of cattle, slaughtering of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. Well, that wouldn't be the case, that they might die if Sennacherib's army had gone. The whole problem would be over with. We'll talk about this expression, tomorrow we die, when we get down to verse 13. But for right now, let's just say that this doesn't sound like feasting because Sennacherib's army had left them completely alone. Option number five, the reason the people in Jerusalem were partying wasn't because of any particular good news, such as I've just mentioned in the previous options, but the partying was because of the general prosperity that ruled in Jerusalem before the Assyrians came. John Gill says some of these people were on business, others on pleasure, some hurrying from place to place about their trade and commerce, and others amusing themselves with pastime, mirth, and jollity, which is commonly the case of populous cities in prosperity. I tend to think that's what it is. I don't think it was a particular event that caused all the revelry. I think they were having a good old time before Sennacherib showed up and said, we're going to get you, Jerusalemites. Isaiah says at the end of verse 2, you are slain, were not killed by the sword, nor did they die in battle. Well, here's three options as to what that might mean. The reason that those who were killed in Israel were not killed in battle is because they were killed by famine instead, the famine caused by Sennacherib's invasion. As John Gill says, for Sennacherib never entered into Jerusalem, nor put any of its inhabitants to the sword. Nor was there any battle fought between them, nor was he suffered so much as to shoot an arrow into it, into the city of Jerusalem. Wherefore those that died in it died either through the fright and consternation they were put into, or through the famine his army had caused in laying the country round about them desolate. Well, it could be that those were slain were not slain by famine inside the city, but in flight outside the city during Sennacherib's invasion. Remember, Sennacherib wiped out a whole bunch of cities of Judah outside of Jerusalem during his famous invasion. And so Isaiah is saying those who were slain were not killed because they ran. They didn't die in open, honorable battle. In fact, the very next verse in chapter 22, verse 3 says, "All your rulers have fled together, captured without a bow. All your fugitives were captured together. They had fled far away." So it sounds like the armies of Hezekiah had run and gotten captured without getting killed because they didn't fight. They weren't honorable. Now, I need to note here that those who were not killed in verse 2 could be those dying of famine within the Jerusalem walls, and those who fled in verse 3 could be troops fighting outside of Jerusalem. In other words, we could have a mixture of option A and option B. Could be both. And there's a third option. That's for those who think that Babylon might be referred to here. Guzik is one. I think Clark was another. But since I don't believe that, I'm not going to mention that option. So the people that died, the people that were slain, were not killed by the sword. Those inside the city died of famine. Those outside the city ran in cowardice because they refused to fight in battle. Verse 3, Isaiah says, "All your leaders have fled together. They have been captured without using the bow." Now, these leaders of the army of Judah didn't do too well, as we can see on the prism of Sennacherib, which is a contemporary source, an archaeological clay tablet, if you will. This is from Gary Smith. 46 strong cities of Judah were taken by Sennacherib. Countless unwalled cities and villages were taken. 2,150 people were taken captive. There was cattle taken. And the prism of Sennacherib says some elite troops deserted Hezekiah. That could be who Isaiah is referring to when he says some have been captured without using the bow. Now, you might stop here and ask, is this prophecy or is this history? Isaiah lived through the events. He could have been just reporting about what's happened. Verse 4, Isaiah says, "Therefore I said, turn away from me, let me weep bitterly. Do not try to console me over the destruction of my people." At least he still identifies with these people. He calls them my people. He says, "Let me weep bitterly." Now, as I just said, if Sennacherib is the subject of this prophecy, and Isaiah knew of it directly, then we're talking about history here, not prophecy, and he's crying over what he's seen. We go now to verses 5 through 8, Isaiah 22. Isaiah says this, the Lord Almighty, has a day of tumult and trampling and terror in the valley of vision, a day of battering down walls and of crying out to the mountains. Elam takes up the quiver with her charioteers and horses. Kir uncovers the shield. Your choicest valleys are full of chariots, and horsemen are posted at the city gates. The defenses of Judah are stripped away, and you looked in that day to the weapons in the palace of the forest. In verse 5, Isaiah says that this day of tumult and trampling is a day of battering down walls. That refers to the battering down walls of the fenced cities, not Jerusalem, of course. Those walls were not battered down, but of the fenced cities, which were beaten down by battering rams, Assyrian battering rams, at the time that Assyria besieged and took these cities. We read in 2 Kings 18:13, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, that's 701 B.C., Sennacherib, king of Assyria, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. Now this day of defeat by the Assyrian army, this day of tumult and trampling and terror, the terror was in the Valley of Vision. That doesn't mean the actual defeat was taking place in Jerusalem, but the terror was in Jerusalem. The people in the outlying cities of Jerusalem had their walls battered down, and the people were crying out to the mountains. Why? Well, a couple of options. Fugitives could be looking to the mountains for help, hoping that perhaps friendly troops might emerge from said mountains. Or it could be that the fugitives were crying to the mountains as they ran to them for protection. In verse 6, Isaiah says, Elam takes up the quiver. Now, Elam is put for the Persians because Elam is a province of Persia. It used to be an independent ancient Near Eastern kingdom way back in the 2000s or so B.C. But by this time, they had become subject to the Assyrians, and they were serving in Sennacherib's army. Sennacherib's army consisted of many nations. We read that in Isaiah 29:7. All the many nations going out to battle against Ariel, that's Jerusalem, all the attackers the siege works against her, all the many nations. John Gill points that out. So Elam, the Elamites are in the Assyrian army. They take up the quiver. As Ellicott points out, at this time Elam, as the inscriptions of Sargon show, Elam was subject to Assyria. So this idea of Elam being in the Assyrian Empire right now is attested to in the archaeological monuments. The Elamites took up a quiver. The Elamites were expert in the use of the bow. Jeremiah 49:35 says, "This is what the Lord of hosts says, I am about to shatter Elam's bow, the source of their might." The Greek geographer Strabo reports that the Elamites had many archers among them, as Gil responds. So, that's why a quiver is mentioned here by Isaiah. Elam takes up the quiver, and those would be taken up by the infantrymen. And then the charioteers and horses are mentioned next, the cavalry. And then in the last part of 6, Kir uncovers the shield. Now, where this Kir is not too precisely known. Gil says it's a city in Media, that's northern Iran, and signified the Medes, who were in subjection to the Assyrians and fought under the Assyrians. Ellicott says it's an unknown city in Mesopotamia. The public commentary points out that Kir is mentioned in 2 Kings 16:9 as the city to which Tiglath-Pileser III transported the inhabitants of Damascus. That would be in 732 BC. We've talked about that in a previous chapter. In 2 Kings 16:9, so the king of Assyria listened to him and marched up to Damascus, listened to King Ahaz of Judah, who was being attacked by Pekah of northern Israel, and Rezin of Syria. Rezin and Pekah having been gotten together in an alliance. So the king of Assyria, that's Tiglath-Pileser III, listened to Ahaz and marched up to Damascus and captured it. Tiglath-Pileser III deported his people to Kir. So it's somewhere in Syria. And as a matter of fact, Kir is mentioned in Amos 9:7 as the original country from which the Syrians were derived. Amos 9:7 says this, "Israelites, are you not like the Cushites to me? This is the Lord's declaration. Didn't I bring Israel from the land of Egypt, the Philistines from Kaphtor," that's probably Cyprus, "and the Arameans, the Syrians, from Kir?" So we're going to take it that Kir is in Syria rather than Media, somewhere out there in the either in Mesopotamia or either east of that, east of the Tigris River in Media, but it's probably in Syria, I would think. Doesn't make any difference. Kir is uncovering the shield. They're in the Assyrian army. They're uncovering the shield because they're getting ready to go to war. Verse 7, "Your choicest valleys are full of chariots." You're referring to the Jerusalemites. "Your choice valleys are full of chariots." That'd be the Kidron Valley, the Tyrrhenian Valley. "Horsemen are posted to the city gates." Jerusalem had a ton of city gates. John Gill gives the reason why the Assyrian army is at the city gates, to take them that come out of the city and to force their way into it, as well as to protect and defend the foot soldiers while they made the assault and scaled the walls, and to be ready when the gates were opened to them. So the people of Jerusalem are bottled up. They can't get out the gates because the Assyrian armies are at the gates, and those Assyrian armies are going to protect the Assyrian foot soldiers who are going to scale the walls and charge through the gates. And so the Israelites are in a heap of trouble. Verse 8, Isaiah says, "The defenses of Judah are stripped away, and you looked in that day to the weapons in the palace of the forest." It's also sometimes called the house of the forest of Lebanon, the palace of the forest of Lebanon. Holman Bible Dictionary describes this palace of the forest as this, quote, "A designation for a great hall Solomon constructed as part of his palace complex in Jerusalem." This is described in 1 Kings 7:2-5. "It is so called because of the extensive use of cedar for the pillars, beams, and roofing material." That's why it's called Palace of the Forest of Lebanon. Lebanon is not mentioned by Isaiah, but that's what it was called. "In this hall were stored 300 shields of gold and vessels of gold." Well, didn't do any good. I think those weapons were already melted down by Hezekiah anyway, trying to buy off Sennacherib, but they either were or about to be melted down. Isaiah continues in Isaiah 22:9-11. Isaiah says this, "You saw that the city of David had many breaches in its defenses. You stored up water in the lower pool. You counted the buildings of Jerusalem and tore down houses to strengthen the wall. You built a reservoir between the two walls for the water of the old pool, but you did not look to the one who made it or have regard for the one who planned it long ago." In verse 9, Isaiah says, "You saw that the city of David had many breaches in it." The city of David is not Jerusalem as a whole, but rather that little promontory of land that stretches out from Mount Moriah on the north to the intersection of the Tyrrhenian and the Kidron Valley in the south. Kind of looks like California. Well, the city of David had many breaches in its defenses. One of my commentators says that the fortifications of the city of David in times of peace had gone to decay. Now, when Jerusalem was in danger, the people of Jerusalem decided they better fix the walls. Probably breaches not from the Assyrian army, but from neglect of the people of the city of Jerusalem. And so the people of Jerusalem are now shoring up the defenses, fixing the breaches in the wall. It's implied there. And then it says, you, Jerusalem, might store up water in the lower pool. Now, the lower pool is the pool of Siloam, also known as the pool of Shiloh. It's called lower. In fact, the pool of Siloam today in Jerusalem, I just saw on Wikipedia, is the lowest spot. Its elevation is lower than any other place in Jerusalem. It was at the southern tip of the city of David, right where the Tyropean Valley runs into the Valley of Hinnom. That's why it's called the Lower Pool. It's low in elevation. Now, I really think that somebody ought to give a PhD in poolology. I have read the articles about the Pool of Siloam and how it's connected to the Springs of Gihon by Hezekiah's Tunnel, which is a tourist site now. And I've read enough on that just to know that I don't know anything. It's so complicated. There's been so much archaeology done there, but I'm going to try to do my best to describe it in general terms. GotQuestions.org says of the Pool of Siloam, the pool was fed by a tunnel Hezekiah cut through almost 2,000 feet of solid rock from the Gihon Spring, also called the Virgin Spring. Now, if you look at the map, and if you'll look at the eastern edge of the city of David, there's a ridge. Well, the city of David is a mountain. Well, it's a mountainous ridge. It's a flat area, but it's up. It has steep walls on the east and the west, and the eastern wall runs down in the Kidron Valley. Well, halfway down that wall is a spring. It's called Gihon Spring, also known as the Virgin Spring. Now, before Hezekiah did his architectural or engineering innovations, water from that spring ran down the hill down there on the eastern side of the city of David, and at some point went up under the wall of Jerusalem and down on into the lower pool, the Pool of Siloam. Well, what Hezekiah did is he put fortifications around, well, I think the fortifications around the Gihon Spring were already there, and then he took the water from the Gihon Spring and ran it through a channel, the one that he dug through 2,000 feet of solid rock, so that it went underground down the side of the city of David that fronts on the Kidron Valley, underground until it went under the wall of the city of Jerusalem. That way no invading army could get the water. And then once the water got under the wall of Jerusalem, the water went on down to the Pool of Siloam. And I'll say here as an aside that it was an incredible feat by Hezekiah to manage to build a tunnel 2,000 feet through solid rock. In fact, archaeological evidence shows that there were some mishaps because they were tunneling from two ends, and sometimes they missed each other, and they had to zig and zag until they made the two ends meet up. Some speculation is that they were hammering on rocks above to let the people digging below to hear so that they could aim toward the sound, but they don't know that for sure. But anyway, it's a remarkable thing. The interesting thing about the Pool of Siloam is how it was used in the New Testament. This is from Got Questions, quote, "But it is during the time of Christ that the Pool of Siloam finds its true significance. Because the pool is near the temple, its water was used for a special ceremony during the Feast of Tabernacles. Each morning during that joyful feast, a priest would take a golden vessel to the Pool of Siloam, fill it with water from the pool, and bring it back to the altar amid the shouts of the people. Then, as the crowd chanted the Hallel, Psalms 113 and 118, that priest poured out the water on the west side of the altar, and another priest poured a drink offering of wine on the east side of the altar. This ritual was probably to illustrate Isaiah 12:3, with joy you will draw water from the wells of salvation. However, on the eighth and final day of the feast, the ritual was not repeated." And that is exactly when Jesus chose to make a startling announcement. "On the last and greatest day of the festival, Jesus stood and said in a loud voice, 'Let anyone who is thirsty come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as Scripture has said, rivers of living water will flow from within them.' On the one day of the feast, when no water was poured, Jesus stood up and filled the gap." Now this lower pool, the Pool of Siloam, is said to have been stopped in 2 Chronicles 32:3-4. So he that's Hezekiah consulted with his officials and his warriors about stopping up the waters of the springs that were outside the city, and they helped him. Many people gathered and stopped up all the springs and the stream that flowed through the land, and they said, "Why should the kings of Assyria come and find plenty of water?" Well, according to James Foss and Brown, what Hezekiah did was he took the waters, the excess waters that were flowing into the Pool of Siloam, which usually just flowed right on down into the Hinnom Valley to the south, And then further on down the Hinnom Valley, as the Hinnom Valley intersects the Kidron Valley, the water just goes that way. So what Hezekiah did, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, he built a wall around the Pool of Siloam, stopping the outflowing of its waters to debar the foe from the use of them and turn them into the city. Well, Wikipedia says that the excess water from the Pool of Siloam could have flowed into a karst subterranean valley. Karst is some kind of a rock formation. I forgot, limestone, something like that. But at any rate, all of this stuff is very interesting. I've just given you a taste of it. This is pretty good Bible studies. This is not exhaustive Bible studies. If you want to really get into some interesting archaeological stuff, you can study the Pool of Siloam, the lower pool. But at any rate, Hezekiah did all this. And Isaiah saying, yeah, you've worked on the lower pool. You've got the water supply safe now. The Assyrians can't get to it. And then in verse 10, you counted the buildings in Jerusalem. Well, why would the Jerusalemites count the buildings in Jerusalem? Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown suggest the reason is in order to see which of them may be pulled down with the least loss to the city, and which of the buildings that were torn down, that were counted, might have the best advantage for the repair of the walls and the rearing of towers. In other words, maybe we should put a tower here. Let's pull the house down. Or maybe this house is getting in the way of where we can put soldiers. Let's tear it down. John Gill says that the houses were counted, or the buildings were counted, to know what number of men were in them and how many could be spared to do duty, either as watchmen or soldiers, or to know how to levy the tax and what money they would be able to raise to defray the charge of the defense of the city, or to see what provisions they had and so make a computation how long they could hold out the siege, or else to observe what houses might be annoyed by the enemy and what stood in the way of the repair of the walls, or were proper to pull down, that with the stones and timber of them they might make up the breaches of the wall. In other words, there was a lot of good military reasons for counting the buildings in Jerusalem and also to tear down the houses. Now, that could refer to houses outside the wall. They're going to be destroyed anyway by the Assyrians, so we might as well tear them down and use the stones to patch up the breaches in the wall or to strengthen the wall. Also, houses outside the wall could harbor the enemy if the Assyrians took them over. So they probably tore down the houses for those reasons. There were also houses inside the wall that might have been torn down. They could have stood in the way of the repair of the wall. A lot of times the houses had their back walls as part of the wall. The wall was the back wall of a house, but sometimes that could have fallen into disrepair. They might need to tear the house down so they can build up the wall at the back of the house and make it strong. And those houses could have been easily beaten down by the enemy. And in fact, those houses could be used as a means of communication between traitors in Jerusalem and the Assyrian enemy. People in the houses could just look out their back window through the wall and say, hey, give me some money, I'll let you into the city. Verse 11, Isaiah says, you people of Jerusalem, have built a reservoir between the two walls of the water of the old pool. Now the reservoir is the lower pool, the Pool of Siloam, a reservoir to hold water. It not only kept water from the Assyrians, it also provided water for the people of Jerusalem during any siege that might come. The two walls, if you look at maps of the Pool of Siloam, there's two walls down there, an exterior wall. Not only was the old wall of Jerusalem repaired, the breaches filled up, but also Hezekiah built an extra wall around that Pool of Siloam. Now, the reservoir was for the water of the old pool, and I looked everywhere. I could not find anybody's opinion on what the old pool stood for. Is it the upper pool, the Gihon Springs, where the water starts from, or is it the lower pool, the Pool of Siloam, where the water ends up? Adam Clark says the old pool is the upper pool. He says there were two pools in or near Jerusalem supplied by springs, the upper pool or the old pool, supplied by the spring called Gihon. But I wonder if the old pool might not be the lower pool, the Pool of Siloam, because when you read this verse, it sounds like it's Siloam. You built a reservoir between the two walls for the water of the Pool of Siloam, for the water of the old pool. But it could be you built a reservoir for the water that's coming from the old pool being Gihon outside the eastern wall of the city on the slope going towards the Kidron Valley. The water that's coming from Gihon there is the water that ends up in the reservoir, which is between the two walls. It's a little bit ambiguous. Now, before I leave this talk of the pools of Jerusalem, let me mention what Clark says. This was so great a work that not only the historians have made particular mention of it in 2 Kings 20:20 and 2 Chronicles 32, but the son of Sirach also has celebrated it in his encomium on Hezekiah. Now, that's some kind of extra canonical literature. I'm not really familiar with it. The tunnel was discovered, according to Wikipedia, sometime in the late 17th century, and the inscription on it that said it belonged to Hezekiah was discovered in the late 19th century. And now, today, tour guides will take you to this tunnel, take you through the tunnel so you can see the inscription in the tunnel. Of course, my tour guide didn't do it, and so I didn't get to see it. One of the places in Jerusalem I really would have loved to have seen. In verse 11, Isaiah says, "You've done all this work on the city, but you did not look to the one who made it, i.e., Yahweh. You did not look to the one who made the reservoir," perhaps. Could refer to Jerusalem, the one who made Jerusalem. Some people say it could refer to the calamity coming from the Assyrians. The "it" is a little bit ambiguous, but it's not unambiguous, the fact that they didn't look to Yahweh for their help. We go now to Isaiah 22, verses 12 through 14. The Lord Almighty, called you on that day to weep and to wail, to tear out your hair and put on sackcloth. But see, there is joy and revelry, slaughtering of cattle and killing of sheep, eating of meat and drinking of wine. Let us eat and drink, you say, for tomorrow we die. The Lord Almighty has revealed this in my hearing. To your dying day, this sin will not be atoned for, says the Lord Almighty. So here we have a bunch of feasting in Jerusalem. I've already mentioned in a previous verse the options on why they were feasting. Well, let's look at this phrase. Eat and drink, be merry, for tomorrow we die. That sounds awful familiar. That's a proverb. I don't know where that came from. Might have come from here for all I know. But we have two ways we can take that. We can say that the people of Jerusalem are literally saying, we know we're going to die tomorrow, so let's just have a good time while we can, because life is short. Or it could be they were mocking Isaiah. Oh, Isaiah, you saying we're going to die tomorrow? Well, let's eat and drink, because we don't believe what you say, Isaiah. We're not going to die tomorrow. For tomorrow we die, ha, ha, ha. Sarcastic use of the phrase. I prefer to think that the Israelites are speaking literally there, not sarcastically. And you might say, well, why would they be feasting and partying knowing that they were going to die tomorrow at the hand of the Assyrians? Well, that happens a lot when disaster looms. I can give you some examples. How about the Babylonians feasting right before the Persians wiped them out in 539, Belshazzar's feast? How about the Germans feasting in cabarets as the Nazis were falling? Or how about the Germans in Hitler's underground bunker getting drunk, having a big party? They knew they were doomed. How about in Neville Shute's fantastic novel in the 1960s, On the Beach? There had been a nuclear war. The Australians, because they were so far away, were preserved from the nuclear fallout. But the Australians, because they were so far away from the war, were preserved at first from the nuclear fallout, but they knew that the wind was blowing the fallout to them and they were all going to die. What were they doing? Now, there was a few of them that went to a Christian revival. Most of them were partying, for tomorrow they were going to die. In verse 14, Isaiah says, "The Lord Almighty has revealed this in my hearing. Till your dying day, this sin will not be atoned for," as Guzik paraphrases. "For this iniquity, there will be no atonement for you. What is this sin that can't be forgiven? The sin of ignoring God, of refusing to humble yourself before the Lord and repent. Jerusalem was doing everything except the essential thing they had to do to prepare for the attack. And because they rejected the Lord, there would be no atonement for them, no covering of their sins, no reconciliation with God." We go now to Isaiah 22, verses 15 through 16. Isaiah continues, "This is what the Lord Almighty says, go, say to this steward, to Shebna, who was in charge of the palace, what are you doing here, and who gave you permission to cut out a grave for yourself here, hewing your grave on the height and chiseling your resting place in the rock?" Now, this Shebna was a treasurer under Hezekiah during the time of Sennacherib's invasion, as we read in Isaiah 36:11, although some say that this Shebna is different here in Isaiah 22 as the Shebna in Isaiah 36. I'm going to assume they're the same people. He was probably connected to the luxury and reveling just condemned by Isaiah, and that's why he's mentioned by name. Note how good King Hezekiah was so ill-served by this worthless official Shebna. Isaiah says, quite abruptly, quite unpleasantly, quite harshly, in verse 16, "What are you doing here?" As Gil paraphrases, "Of thy family and kindred, what ancestors hast thou? Where did they live or die and were buried? What children hast thou to succeed thee in honor and estate? Or what relations to be interred, when deceased in thy grave, that thou hast made such a provision as follows? That's some fancy King James English. I love how a 19th century commentator is so used to the King James Version, when he makes up conversations, he puts those conversations in King James English. But basically what he's saying is, Shebna, what do you need a grave for your descendants? You're a nobody. You're a nothing burger. Shebna was thinking he was going to live and die in Jerusalem, so he needed a sepulcher for himself and his family to lie in great pomp and splendor like the kings and princes of the earth, as Gill says. Well, if he believed that, he wouldn't believe any of Isaiah's prophecies that bad times are coming, that they're going to get whacked. Isaiah says that Shebna has hewed his grave on the height. That would be in a lofty place so that it would be more conspicuous. As James Fawcett Brown say, that sepulchres were usually made in the highest rocks, and they were often palatial. So Shebna has chiseled his resting place in the rock, but it's not going to do him any good. Because we read in Isaiah 22, 17 through 19, the verses following, Isaiah continues, "Beware, the Lord is about to take firm hold of you, Shebna, and hurl you away, O you mighty man. He will roll you up tightly like a ball and throw you into a large country. There you will die, and there your splendid chariots will remain, you disgrace to your master's house." Ooh, talk about speaking truth to power. "I will depose you from your office, and you will be ousted from your position." So Shebna's going to be thrown up like a ball, rolled up like a ball, thrown into the desert. The large country is some kind of desert. And a ball will roll a long way in the desert, especially if the wind's behind it, with nothing to stop it. This large country, some say it's Babylon. Barnes says it's probably Assyria. When this was done, we have no means of determining because we don't know any more about Shebna, but I can assure you it happened. Isaiah says that Shebna's splendid chariots are going to remain there in the desert in the large country. These chariots, of course, were used in pomp and splendor during state ceremonies. They weren't just used for military actions. A lot of good they're going to do Shebna. Now, I can't help but ask myself right now, why does Isaiah break off with this denunciation on Jerusalem to denounce one particular official of Jerusalem? I don't know why he did that. But for those who are interested in politics, officials are very important. Isaiah was interested in the politics of Judah. It could be that Isaiah was just trying to show the downfall of one man as an object lesson to all the Jerusalemites to show that, hey, this whole nation is going down. Now, of course, they didn't go down when Sennacherib attacked. They had a reprieve. They eventually went down in 586. But they almost went down. If it hadn't been for the grace of God, they would have been destroyed. And they had to undergo a famine and a siege, which is a lot worse than all the feasting and partying they were doing. We go now to Isaiah 22, verses 20 through 25, and we will finish this chapter. Isaiah continues, "In that day I will summon my servant, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. I will clothe him with your robe and fasten your sash around him and hand your authority over to him." In other words, Shebna's authority and sash and robe, which are symbols of authority, would be handed over to a new guy, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah. "He will be a father to those who live in Jerusalem. A father is one who protects, and the people of Jerusalem needed protection. Eliakim was going to do that to those who live in Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. I will place on his shoulder the key to the house of David. What he opens, no one can shut, and what he shuts, no one can open. I will drive him like a peg into a firm place. He will be a seat of honor for the house of his father. All the glory of his family will hang on him, its offspring and offshoots, all its lesser vessels from the bowls to all the jars. In that day, declares the Lord Almighty, the peg driven into the firm place will give way, it will be sheared off and will fall, and the load hanging on it will be cut down. The Lord has spoken." Now in verse 20, Isaiah says, "In that day," what day was that? That would be the day when Shebna is deposed. "On that day when Shebna is deposed, then Eliakim will be summoned." Now there is a little problem in Isaiah 36. Both Shebna and Eliakim are in office at the same time. Shebna is called the steward in Isaiah 22, and he's a secretary in Isaiah 36. Well, how do you explain the fact that they're in office at the same time where Isaiah 22 has one supplanting the other? Here's some hypothetical solutions. First of all, we can say that Shebna in Isaiah 22 was a different man than the Shebna in Isaiah 36. But I've already said I believe they're the same, just easier that way. So another way to solve this problem is to say that Shebna was demoted from steward to secretary right before Sennacherib's attack in Isaiah 36. So when we read 36 and see them both in the same office, we just assume that Shebna was in the office and then Eliakim was in the office successively. Now who this Eliakim son of Hilkiah was, Gill, Clark, and Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that he was the same man as named Azariah the son of Hilkiah. two different names. He was a ruler over the house of God in the times of Hezekiah. He was a good man, a faithful, diligent, and constant servant of the Lord. He did not seek great things for himself, nor did he thrust himself into the office. Some people even say he's a type of Christ because his name signifies my God will raise up. Well, that's a whole lot of speculation. Guzik says, on the other hand, Eliakim was an assistant to Hezekiah, who is explicitly named Eliakim. And of course, he should be distinguished from that king of Judah, the son of Josiah, Eliakim, the puppet king established by the Pharaoh. Of course, it's not the same guy. Not much is said about this Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, in the scripture, so we don't care who he is. Now, he's going to be clothed with the robe and a sash that Shebna used to have. That symbolized Shebna's authority. Eliakim's got it now. The sash is a symbol of strength. It's like a girdle. It goes around the waist as well as around the chest. Now, in verse 22, that's God, will place on Eliakim's shoulder the key to the house of David. What is that key? Here's some options that have been given by the commentators. The magistrates actually carried a key on their shoulder. The key hung down from the shoulder because the shoulder had a hook at one end. Well, the key had a hook on its end, and it hooked into the shoulder of the magistrate, so it would be a literal key. Option number two, it was an embroidered key that was embroidered on that part of the garment, on the shoulder of the garment. Or it's not a physical key of either type, but it's rather a symbol for the authority of the magistrate, because the magistrate sustains the government on his shoulders. I tend to think that's what it is. I will place on his shoulder the key to the house of David, on Eliakim's shoulder, which he opens, no one can shut, and when he shuts, no one can open. In other words, he's got authority, nobody else does, to go in to the house of David, into the royal household. Verse 23, God will drive him like a peg into a firm place. Now, a peg could be a peg in a wall on which things are hung, and in fact, we're going to see things are hung in verse 24. All the glory of his family will hang on him. So that's probably what it refers to here. Could be a tent peg, or it could be a peg holding two timbers together, but I don't think so. And verse 24, all the glory of Eliakim's family will hang on this peg, will hang on him, its offsprings and offshoots, all of its lesser vessels, from the bowls to all the jars. Well, what are the lesser vessels, the bowls and the jars? What are they a symbol of? As Gill says, meaning those of his family that were some of lesser, others of greater capacities, just like some bowls are bigger than others. For whom Eliakim provided places and posts under him, suitable thereunto. None were forgotten or neglected by him. This simile of vessels of various sorts and sizes is made use of in perfect agreement with Eliakim's being compared to a nail on which vessels in a house are hung by their handles. Now we go to verse 25. In that day, declares the Lord Almighty, the peg driven into the firm place will give way. Now, this is a problem. One of the old commentators said, this verse is an enigma. The reason it's an enigma, because it sounds like the peg is the same peg that was just talked about in verse 23, namely Eliakim, when all kind of great things is happening to Eliakim. He's going to be hanging his descendants from himself, and he's nailed into the wall like a firm peg. He will have a seat of honor. He will have a glorious family, glorious offsprings and offshoots. Things are going great. And all of a sudden in verse 25, the peg is sheared off and gives way. Well, I examined the commentators on this issue. Now, it's a minor issue, but it's really interesting. It's like the battle of the commentators. Some people say it refers back to Shebna, because Shebna had just lost his job. But the problem with that, it says the peg driven into the firm place. But verse 23 says, I will drive him, Eliakim, like a peg into a firm place. It sounds like Eliakim, but I found three commentators who disagreed with that, Barnes, Benson, and Poole. Some of the talk dogs in the commentary world. However, I found four commentators who said it's Eliakim: Cambridge, Ellicott, Kyle, and Delitch in the Pulpit Commentary. Here's what Ellicott says. Here, as in the case of Shebna, we have no record of the fulfillment of the prediction, but it is a natural inference from its remaining in the collected prophecies of Isaiah, either that it was fulfilled or that it did its work as a warning and that the penalty was averted by a timely reformation. So Ellicott thinks it's Eliakim, even though we don't know when the prophecy was fulfilled. The Pulpit Commentator says, it is impossible to understand this peg of Shebna. So that commentary is very firm on the idea that it's Eliakim, Colin Delitzsch say this, "The prophet could not express in clearer terms the identity of the peg threatened here with Eliakim himself. For how is it conceivable that the prophet could turn all that he has predicted of Eliakim in Isaiah 22, 23, and 24 into predicates of Shebna?" That's what I've just said. So I believe it's Eliakim. I don't see how you can get around that, despite certain commentators' strong assertions to the contrary. So now Eliakim goes down. Why is Isaiah talking about two officials going down? I suppose what he's trying to say is, don't think your strong walls of Jerusalem are going to protect you from Assyria. Don't think all the repaired breaches, the houses that you tore down, the water supply that you guaranteed, don't think that's going to save you. I'm going to prophesy to you about two big shot officials of Judah who are going to lose their jobs. Nothing is secure, and you're not secure either, people of Jerusalem, because Sennacherib is coming. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 22. We are now prepared to go to chapter 23, which I will call an oracle concerning Tyre and Sidon, as Isaiah continues his jeremiads against the nations of the ancient Near East. I hope to see you in our next audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.